everybody. My name's Julie Thatcher. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Close enough? Okay, good. Thank you, Carol. I like literally just got my tears dried from listening to Jason. Are you guys all mopped up? Is everybody like pulled it back in again? Have you stopped crying? If he's the weakest link, then I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm really grateful to be here. I am always humbled to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm really grateful that I get to share this this podium with amazing examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're all sitting here at this table, and I feel really blessed to be among them and to be among you. I adore Carol. I love sponsoring. I grow with each and every sponsee. Every sponsee unlocks my heart and helps me learn something new. And sometimes it's tremendous patience, and sometimes it's to have an amazing sense of humor, and sometimes it is just to have this deep and lasting, profound experience where I get to really see the God in you and you see the God in me, and we grow hand in hand and walk shoulder to shoulder. And Carol is that with me, not for me, but with me. And she is a precious, precious child of this program, as am I, as are we all. So we don't do this, but if you're new, if you have like 30 days or less, would you raise your hand just so I can see who's new? Welcome. Hopefully the people at your table are now jumping on you, or at least they'll wait until I'm done and you don't have to have a conversation when this is over. You don't have to wander off on your own. You're welcome here. We're so happy to have you here. My sobriety date is August 5th of 1987. I got sober very young. I live in Seattle, Washington. My home group is the Empire Way Group. If and when you travel to Seattle, you can. I'm come to Empire Way. I'm easy to spot. I'm easy to find. I would love to host you, and I'll save you a chair and pour you a cup of coffee. I love my home group. I am active in my home group. I never miss my home group. And I've lived in Seattle about 10 years, 10, 12 years, something like that. I got sober back in upstate New York, and I've lived all over the country in sobriety. I'll just tell you my story. I started drinking at a very, very early age, obviously because I got sober at a very early age. I know you're already thinking that based on my sobriety date, right? I got sober as a teenager. I've never actually had a legal drink. But I needed alcohol like nobody's business. I was that kid who I wasn't quite like Jason. I was more of the dark hellion. I was the goth before it was goth. I was obsessed with how to get out and off the planet. I wasn't trying to get all up in your business. I was trying to get all the way out, because I, from the day one, never fit in, never belonged. I had all of the things that the big book describes alcoholics have from the beginning: restless, irritable, discontent, obstinate, unreasoning prejudice, sensitive, undisciplined, nervous disposition. I mean, all of these terms in the big book are used to describe alcoholics in one way or another. Today, I think we call it anxiety and depression. But the big book has many, many different terms for it, and I had all of it. I had all of it. My parents are not alcoholics. I grew up in like a middle-class neighborhood, and both of my parents have alcoholic parents. So they both escaped alcoholism. They found each other, and then they had me. And they didn't quite know what to do with me when I came out all dark and intense. But I was described as a child as someone who was angry. I had fits. I had tantrums. I never got my way, and I never knew even what my way was. But I just knew I wasn't getting it. And so for me, alcohol became almost medicine. It was never a party. It was never like, oh, hey, we're going to go do a fun thing. Come with us and let's do a fun thing. For me, it was, let me try some of this because my parents are doing it all the time. You know, not to drunkenness, but there was booze around the house. And so I drank it all the time. And as soon as I really started to feel the effects of alcohol, I was all in. I wanted it bad. And I didn't care anymore. I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't care about school. I didn't care about grades. I didn't care about friends. I didn't care about my parents. I didn't care about anything. And, you know, I was so dark that really early on, maybe even as I'm starting to explore my drinking, I remember we had this assignment in school to write the 5-paragraph essay. You know, the 5-paragraph essay where you know, introduction and then 3 paragraphs on what you're going to do, or, you know, a how-to, and then a concluding paragraph. And I literally worked on this assignment, and my topic was how to commit suicide. And I didn't ask anybody about it. I didn't tell anybody about it, but I picked 3 methods to exit the planet quickly. And I wrote about each and every one, positives and negatives, and then I summarized with, like, my method, right? And handed it in, just like every other kid in my class, and it was the first time I got to meet the school counselor. And it was the first of many times I would meet the school counselor. It was the first of many times my parents would get a call, and it was the first of many times that well-meaning adults would look at me with this look of, you have so much potential, and you're throwing it away, and don't you know how many people you're hurting? And I would love to help you and help save you and pave a path for you. And that left me empty. It left me empty every single time. Drinking was curative. I don't think I would be on the planet. I really don't. I really didn't want to be here. But drinking let me be here longer. And once I started to really drink, then all bets were off, as I've already said. And I started to do all the things that young girls do to get and stay drunk. It's pretty easy when you're a young girl to get and stay drunk. And I have some of the, you know, the wear and tear, the scars, the pain, the, you know, memories of things that I did to get and stay drunk. And I don't need to go into it any more than that. But if you're a young girl alcoholic, you might be able to relate. My drinking was, created this whirlwind in the house. I have a younger sister. We had a dog. The house was always, in chaos because of me and my drinking, unless I was running away or not home and, you know, nobody could find me. It was bad. It was really bad. My parents sought help. They tried Al-Anon. They went to meetings. I think they showed up at meetings and said, how do I get my daughter to stop acting this way? And Al-Anon said, have a seat, and here's some literature, and welcome. And they said, no, I'm here not for me. I don't need your literature. I don't need your seat. I need, like, how do we fix this? And they said, well, that's not what we do. And so they went off and got a book called Tough Love. I don't know if anybody's heard of this book, but my parents adopted a tough love program. This is the best way I can say it. And they got some interventions in place. They wrote out a contract of how Julie was supposed to be in the house. And they had another well-meaning adult professional come into the house and talk me through what would happen if I didn't follow this contract, which included, of course, not drinking and not taking any substances, not hitting anybody, not raging on anybody, going to school, you know, coming home at night. I mean, I don't even know if, like, being a decent human being or being, like, you would have to explain that to me, but, you know, it may or may not have said that, but, you know, my mom's crying, my dad is stern, there's a professional in the room, and they're, you know, it's like a mini intervention of sorts, I guess. And I signed the contract because, of course, I don't want to make my dad mad and my mom cry and my sister go hide in the corner and read a book and hope that none of this chaos touches her. So I sign, and then I go out, and then I pick up a drink, because if there's a drink in front of me, I'm picking it up, because I might want to act right, but I do not want to give up the magic elixir that makes it okay for me to be here with you on the planet. But the minute I pick up, all this other chaos happens again. I mean, for me as an alcoholic, it was so easy to see unmanageability. A lot of people come in and they struggle with, you know, I know I'm powerless, but, you know, I still have some stuff. You know, my life maybe isn't unmanageable. For me, it was unmanageable from the gate. But I was never believed I was powerless, because I chose, or so I thought, with gusto every single drop I ever drank. I wanted everything I put in my body. I never tried to quit. Why would you quit? That's the silliest thing. I mean, I want to act right. I want my life to be okay, but I need to keep going. So anyway, I do all the things that I'm not supposed to do, and all the consequences happened. And within a really quick period of time, my parents changed the locks on the house. They put my belongings in big black hefty bags, put them in the garage. I was really young, and they didn't want somebody out there. I mean, I was in their care. I'm their child, so they didn't want me out on the street responsible for anything that I'm going to do in my ripping and running and roaring around. And so they literally drove me to the courthouse and stood in front of the judge and said, "We don't want her anymore," and signed me over to the state of New York. And I went instantly into shackles and to a cage. They put me in a cage behind the courtroom. And I waited for transport to go to my first detention center. And that really started, for me, the intensity of my alcoholism, the urgency for me to get drunk and stay drunk. And for somebody who knew, kind of always knew, that there wasn't a place for me here on the planet, to have my parents actually walk me to the courthouse and say, "No, really, there is no place for her in our home, in our lives. We don't want her. You have to take her. We can't deal with her." Something broke and something happened that just made all that drinking even more necessary. So I went through cycle after cycle. This started the whole, just sort of a whirlwind of, I went to detention. I was often sent from detention to a foster home. I lived with foster family on and off many times through this period, and so I always ended up at some rural upstate New York school picking apples in the apple orchard for my job. It was very surreal. I often would run away. There were other beds for other foster kids, so I would, we would get together and, go hitchhike back to the city, and so we could drink. The police in my town knew my name. They knew my parents. I was often spotted and picked up and sent right back into the system. New York State, mom and dad did all the assessments, the ink blots, the evaluations to figure out what was wrong. I did have evaluations for alcoholism. At one point, the first time they evaluated me, I have you know that they said I was not an alcoholic because I was too young, but that I had great potential. So they put me in a certain kind of program for people who had great potential to become alcoholics, and I had to go to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was in a hospital, and there were a lot of old people there, kind of like how we all look now, really old to a young teenager, and I was like, oh, my good Lord in heaven above, this is not where I want to end up. It was like diversion therapy to go to an AA meeting, but every time I did something court ordered successfully, I was able to go home. So every time I went back home, it was like a new contract. It was like a clean slate. And every time I went back home, I would run into somebody who had some booze. And every time I picked up, all bets were off. And I broke hearts over and over and over again. Another cycle of another treatment center, same story. Another cycle of another treatment center, same story. But the final time that I went to treatment, I was flown from New York to Minnesota, and I went to a treatment center in Minneapolis. Not the treatment center you're thinking of, not the Grand Poobah Treatment Center, but a different treatment center in Minnesota that specialized in like chronic relapsing badass alcoholic teenagers or something like that. Because we had all been to treatment, we had all been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous multiple times, and I mean, I could pretty much swindle a really good treatment center counselor. I could give a good first step talk. I could draw a picture of a higher power. I could follow the assignment. I could comply with what you were asking me, because at this point I'd grown up, in an institution, one or another, a detention, foster, different treatment centers, you know, all with these well-meaning adults who would look at me and say, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? You know, let's help you. And I had well-meaning adults who tried to help me, and I took them for a ride as much as I don't think I meant to, but I just didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I certainly, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem like a viable solution because I didn't want to hang out with all y'all old people and like go bowling for the rest of my life, you know? And I still needed to drink. I still needed to drink. But my final treatment center, I was in for 5 months, 5 long months. I mean, this was early mid-80s before treatment centers were really, well, I would say before insurance really figured out this 28-day, like they'll pay for 28 days or whatever it was. They were still figuring out treatment centers, and treatment centers were still popping up everywhere. It was kind of the heyday of treatment center treatment centers just opening up and taking our money to help dry us up and get us our first, you know, 30, 60, 90 days of sobriety. So anyway, the white van, I was in the white van every week, and we would go to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the same kind of room, the same kind of old people, the same coffee and cookies on the back table. And I, for some reason, I don't know if it was because I was there long enough in this treatment center long enough and went to the same meeting enough times that I started to feel kind of good when I walked in the room. And I think it was even more than just having the coffee and the cookies, which was a draw. I give Jason that. I mean, there were boys there too for me, which was, you know, I think he said coffee, like sugar, caffeine, and the girls, right? Yeah, same thing, same. Very attractive to have the coffee, the cookies, and the boys. But I'll tell you what, there was something there. There was something there for me, for a kid who really knew she wasn't welcome anywhere, to have people who I started to recognize week after week after week say, welcome, you're welcome here, to smile at me and offer me a seat, a place to be, a place to call home for just an hour. And they weren't paid. They weren't paid to do this. I didn't figure that out for a little bit, that the AA portion was for fun and for free. I started to feel that little attraction. I mean, every place I went, somebody was paid to watch over me or keep track of me or heal me or fix me or something. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you didn't shove anything on me. You just wanted to know if I wanted a cup of coffee and told me I was welcome. And I think I was attracted to that, you know, the traditions practiced by that group, because I can't imagine that a van full of juvenile delinquents who had been to treatment a number of times that were vibrating in the back of the room from coffee and cookies were not making a huge disturbance. But for some reason, you continued to invite us and you continued to welcome us and make us feel like we had a place in your rooms. And I thank you for that. I thank you for that. I think that's why I love newcomers so much. I mean, it just reminds me, you know, how important it is. You know, sometimes service work is like the most important thing we can do is smile. You know, the most important thing we can do is have that kindness in our eyes for somebody, whether they're new or whether they just look a little bit, you know, out of place, or whether they look like they just don't quite fit in. Because I don't know about you, but I can walk around with 36 years of sobriety and walk into a room and go, oh, I don't know if they're going to like me in this room, and have that anxious apartness like that. And there is nothing like the kind eyes of somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous to just change all that in a heartbeat. And I just, you know, sometimes when I'm going to meetings, I just say a prayer as I'm driving up, like, God, help me help someone. Show me the person. And I get to find the person. Or often the person finds me, and it changes my day. It changes my life to be that for somebody else. And you taught me how to do that first by doing it for me and giving me a seat in our rooms. Even though I was young, even though I was crazy, even though I was somebody you wouldn't otherwise want to sit next to or give a hug to, I wasn't quite the creature of loveliness that stands before you. I should mention that too. I was a little stinky. I was probably 80 pounds bigger than I am now. I had an angry look. I wore dark makeup. I dyed my hair black. I mean, I was not like the huggable newcomer. But you hugged me, and I love you for that. So I completed 5 months successfully. I got to go home. I went home with a big book. I had worked all the way up through step five. I didn't do it honestly. I mean, I prayed to something. I drew some picture of a God that the group liked, and so I passed that step. I wrote a fourth step. Not out of the big book, and I read whatever I did to the person that they shipped in to the treatment center, and he said I did a really great job. I lied on it, so I mean, it was a great fifth step. It wasn't my fifth step, but I did a really good performance. And that allowed me to pass step five, so I was getting closer and closer to going home. And they sent me home with a pamphlet called Step 6 and 7, The Forgotten Steps, was the title of the pamphlet of those steps. So I was like, cool, I can do that. And they told me to get a sponsor. They sent me home with a big book. They told me to go to meetings. And here I am. I'm in AA for the rest of my life, and I'm going to go bowling with the old people, you know? So I go home, my parents let me, come home. I start going to meetings. I do the newcomer half measure thing. I come in, I'm a little bit late, I leave a little bit early, I have a big book. It's the most boring piece of words on a page I had ever been introduced to. I mean, anytime I was exhausted, and had insomnia, because who knows why you have insomnia? I mean, you go to a meeting and drink a pot of coffee and then go home and wonder why I can't go to sleep. So I crack open the big book and I couldn't get much past War Fever Ran High in the small New England town. I was like, no. That was about as much as the big book ever did for me. And, there was a woman in Rochester, New York, where I got sober, who had the title of Julie Sponsor. I don't believe that she ever sponsored me or that I ever used her as a sponsor, but I did ask somebody, so technically I could check that thing off the list. And, I kind of circled around the edges. And how it works. It says it right there. We read it in almost every single meeting. Half measures avail us nothing, right? Not half. Not even a quarter. Not much. And thank God, nothing, because what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, half measuring, was not enough to relieve my alcoholism. And I am somebody who has alcoholism really badly between my ears. And the only thing that I know that works is drinking. And so when I'm not drinking and that thing is still happening between my ears, I have no place to go. And circling around your edges wasn't cutting it. I would circle around the edges because I knew I wasn't really welcome in the middle, because there wasn't a place for me, because nobody was listening to me or hearing me, because there wasn't a place to break in. And I'm sure there were avenues in all over the place, but, with my alcoholic blinders on, I just did the bare minimum and thought I was good. Let's just call it good. And I would go home at night and I would lay in bed and I would think of my suicide plan. You know what I mean? I would think, like, how long do I have to be here? How long do I have to be here? And thank God I drank one more time. I stayed sober 5 months on the ins and 5 months on the outs. And my last drunk was terrifying because I didn't choose it. I didn't want it. I didn't plan it. But I ran into somebody who, at the movies, who had a wine cooler in the inside pocket, because, when you're a kid, that's what, those are your movie snacks, right? Your wine cooler is in the inside of your trench coat in late July. So I run into somebody and, hands me a wine cooler. And, without even thinking, I'm like, oh, hey, what's up? And I start drinking. And as it's going down my throat, it hits me like, oh, actually, I'm not actually supposed to be doing this. I'm drinking and I'm struck. I'm struck in the moment with the feeling of, the bubble fizz of the booze going down my throat. And I think, oh, God, I'm going to have to raise my hand again. I'm going to have to be a newcomer again. I had 10 months, and now I'm going to have to, go to the room, and, they're going to have to see me one more cycle through, raise my hand. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to have to change my date, it's not going to be over a sip of a wine cooler now, is it? Really, people, really? So I go out and I'm out of the house. I'm kicked out, thrown out, run away. I don't even actually remember. But I go on a tear. I go on a really good tear. And this was the most important tear of my life, because it showed me that I drank beyond when I wanted to. It showed me no matter how much I drink, I can't get drunk enough. you had loved enough of me and long enough. I had been to just enough AA meetings that somehow you got in there, and I couldn't drink you out of my head and out of my life and out of my gut and out of my consciousness. And I spent days trying not to drink and trying to drink and trying not to drink and trying to get drunk, and nothing worked. And, you know, my parents had disowned me again. The friends that I had found, actually, I had no friends. It was my cousin. I drank with my cousin at this point because I had no friends left. My cousin disowned me at that point, and I found myself in some guy's basement drinking around the clock with him. His girlfriend did not like that very much, and they were having violent fits, and he was beating her up in front of me. I mean, it was like really scary stuff, really scary stuff. And I couldn't get drunk enough to drink it away. And I reached that moment, you know, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, that jumping off place where I knew that I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I knew that the liquid that conforms to a glass is something that I cannot control or enjoy. The alcoholism I knew I had. I mean, I know I have this stuff, but then when it connected with the booze, I knew it was time, and I quit. And I quit that day, and I haven't had a drink since. And I tell you what, I went right back into those meetings, those same meetings with all y'all old people, and all of a sudden, the rooms were really different. I mean, really different. I walked in, I raised my hand as a newcomer, and I had no more answers. I had no more excuses. I cried that first night, and I got a bunch of little slips of paper. Just to give you a sense of the date, of the timing, we had no cell phones. We had no internet, which means like no email, no surfing, no electronic distraction. Change in the pockets to call people in Alcoholics Anonymous from phones that used to exist on the street, where when you need to reach somebody, you go to a phone on the street and you deposit money, and then you call somebody and you memorize the number because, God forbid, you get caught without your sponsor's number between your two ears, right? So I am shaking it out, don't belong. My parents kicked me out again. I called a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She picked me up. She did not become my sponsor. She was actually one of my aftercare treatment counselors. And so she came and picked me up off my last drunk. And she somehow talked my parents into letting me come home and sleep it off at home. And I lived at home for a couple of months, my first few months of sobriety. I didn't have a whole lot going on. I did everything was Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to be in meetings 24/7 because all of a sudden, you guys were like really funny and really wise and really delightful to be around. And, you know, I mean, before you were boring, before First Step, oh my gosh, just a bunch of old people. After my first step, you were like a miracle. You were a miracle. And I wanted to be with you and around you because you were the only place where I felt safe. You were the only place where I felt loved. You were the only place where I felt any kind of hope whatsoever. And so I went to the clubhouses. I got jobs, meaning I was coffee making. I was doing all the stuff and all the things. Like every meeting I went to felt like my home group. You know, I mean, every place I went, I made home. And then in between meetings, where there's no cell phone and no electronic distraction and no place to go because I'm a high school dropout and I don't have a job because I'm unemployable. I have no job skills other than picking apples in the foster home. Not a good thing to put on your resume. And, high school dropout is not a good thing to put on your resume. I used to go to the homes of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were two women in particular who lived about a block from each other, block and a half from each other, Ellen and Terry. And if I wasn't at one of their homes, I was at the other. They each had, I kid you not, they had four kids each. So between them, eight children. And Ellen and I have about the same sobriety date. She came in a little bit before me, and her husband was off earning a living. I was off in meetings around the clock. Ellen was home with four really young kids just trying to be sober. And so I would go to her house And at this point, my parents had kicked me out again because I was not going to school and I was not working. And they said, "You're not doing anything. We don't want you here. We still don't want you here, unless you're a productive member of society." And I was like, "I'm in AA. Isn't AA a productive member of society? Is that enough? Isn't that enough?" They said, "No can do." So I was off on my own. I finagled my way into a job. I have been supporting myself before I was even old enough to sign a lease. But Alan and Terry taught me how to live. You know, I would go to their houses and help them fold laundry, help them make macaroni and cheese, you know, spaghetti for dinner. I learned how to do dishes. I learned how to not be scary. I learned how to not cheat at the card games with the young kids, because apparently they're supposed to win at Candyland. It's not me. I'm the one that's not supposed to win, right? These are like basic life skills that I did not have before coming into contact with Ellen and Terry. But, you know, the meetings were where I could find the medicine, but the love, the compassion, the connection, the fellowship I found outside of these rooms. You know, I mean, it's here. This is where I meet you. But when I go to your homes and when I fellowship with you and when we do things together, that's how I see how you live. That's how I learn how to live, how to be kind, how to think of you and not just me. And when I could sense that Ellen was getting just a little bit like, okay, Julie's been here long enough, I would walk a block and a half to Terry's house and knock on the door. And I swear to you, neither of them would ever turn me away. I was always welcome in their homes. And their kids started to think of me as like Aunt Julie, you know? And their families would invite me for dinner. I became a part of. And in that, I became even more deeply a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's the thing. God is so amazing, because little did I know that I was being abundantly set up to start making amends to this man and this woman who had written me off as a daughter. Because at some point, I need to let go. I need to like wipe the chip off my shoulder and put myself in their shoes and imagine what it was like to raise an alcoholic like me and to start going back home when I'm invited and start acting like the kind of person who can help make the macaroni and cheese, who can help do the dishes, and who can actually not cheat at the card game when we're done with dinner. And these life skills I could not have had without the kindness and compassion of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who took extra time to welcome me home. And your home became my home so that my home could be our home. And little by slow, I would go home and I would do dishes and I would watch my mom look at my dad. I would watch those little side glances of like, oh, that's new. Oh, that's new. Oh, that's new. I haven't seen that one before. You know, my sister would come a little bit out of hiding. My sweet sister, she's 4 years younger than me, and she's amazing. She's not an alcoholic, but she was raised in an alcoholic family, and I am the alcoholic. So I have a responsibility to be a family member that brings peace and love and compassion and service into the home. And we have grown so much together, my sister and I. My sister actually called me when I was about 10 years sober. I had made amends to my sister. I had done all the, you know, I'd had the conversation. I'd written about her. I had done some good big sister things here and there. But I didn't really spend that much time with her. I didn't really think about her all that much. She called me when I was about 10 years sober, crying and angry. And she yelled at me and she said, "I'm in therapy. I'm in therapy because I have sister issues. Most people go because they have mother issues, but I have sister issues." And I thought, oh, okay, my work is not done. My work is not done. And, you know, and today, I mean, that's decades ago. And since that time, you know, she read me the riot act. She was like, "You never call me. You never check in on me. I always have to call you. I have to track you down." And I thought, oh, my gosh, I better bring this to my sponsor. I thought, like, talking to my sponsor and figuring out what I did and what I say and saying the things is done. I'm done. I'm good. But our big book talks about, you know, that larger demonstration ahead. The word demonstration is used so many times in the first 164 pages. It's how we act this thing out. It's not what I know. It's not what I hear. It's not what I see. It's how I behave in the lives of others that really make the profound difference between an amend, you know, an amend to be compliant with amends versus forgiveness, which is like something that I'm asking you for and I'm extending to you, versus the ultimate reconciliation, where we come into relationship new and different. We're reconciled and we can move forward. I was nowhere near reconciled with my sister when she made that call. So I started acting differently with her. And she, again, is my dearest, closest friend. And I'll tell you a story about her, totally out of order, but I don't know, we'll see where this is going. My sister and I am recently separated from my husband of 25 years, and I am living at my sister's house. My sister and I have been going on what we call sister walks. We started in the pandemic, where, you know, we just would get together one morning a week, and we would hike every week, every Thursday morning, and there was something really magical about it, where I would tell her all that's going on with me, and she would tell me all that's going on with her, and it's been years that I've been, like, you know, thinking about, you know, about my marriage, and right from the very beginning, she has said, I've got you. We've got you. She and her wife, we've got you. And so when it came time for me to actually, when the indicated next step was to not live in my home anymore, I called my sister, and she has me. And I got to move into their house and be a guest and have my little sister take care of big sister and really, really love me and care for me. And now I live in their back. Now I just pay rent in their detached ADU in the backyard. But here's the thing. Here's the magic. Like that, you would think that's enough. But what really happened is I had somebody over. This is kind of a fresh story, so I might just weep in front of you. But I had somebody from the program over for dinner. And the four of us, my sister, her wife, and my friend, and myself were having dinner. And we were talking about amends stories. And my sister says to me, I don't remember you ever making amends to me like that. I thought, well, I did. I mean, I remember it, but she does. She didn't remember it. She has no memory of it. And so I assured her that I did, and I thought that was enough. But then I went to bed, and then, you know, that thing that happens. You know, I couldn't sleep. Something's wrong. What's going on? I call my sponsor, and I say, I think my sister deserves a memory, an experience of having a true amend from me. And I wrote it the very next day. I ran it by my sponsor, of course, because even with decades, I still want my sponsor to, if I'm going to go out there and be Alcoholics Anonymous, I need that sponsor verified first, okay? Just saying. And I wrote this letter to my sister that said, I really regret that I robbed you of a childhood. I regret that we had parents that were really concerned with me and my drinking and my behavior, such that your childhood was taken from you. And when they should have been caring for you, they were worrying about me. When they should have been taking you to things, they were driving to the courthouse. You know, you had to have the chaos of alcoholism in your home. And that was my fault. And I know that that leaves scars. And today, what I am and what I will be is your sister, your confidant, your best friend. As our mother declines in Alzheimer's, which we're holding each other's hands, walking through together, as our dad doubles down on whatever, however our dad is, with his own twists and of personality, I've got your back, I'm your friend, I'm here for you, and I trust that you're here for me, and together we'll do this. And Sharon, I read it to Sharon, and she said, I love it, it's beautiful, I wouldn't change a thing. Read it to her and give it to her. I want her to have something. So I made an appointment. I read it to her. I wept. She wept. We hugged. And she has an amends experience. She's had a little amends and a lifetime of demonstration. And I know that my words are good. And she knows that my words are good because I've been acting out those words for years and years and years. And thank you, God. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for repairing relationships, repairing and restoring relationships. And you know, my the relationships with my parents, oh my gosh, there was such a road of reconstruction ahead, and I really did take the lead. I really did. I moved. First of all, it was really easy to make amends when I didn't live in the same state. I highly recommend not living in the same state. Going home for visits, for short bursts of visits, was amazing because I could muster it up for like a week at a time, 2 weeks at a time. And then multiple times a year we would do it, right? And then I did things like I started graduating from things. I was a high school dropout, but I had the desire to do more, be different. So I went to school and I got a high school diploma in community college, and then I got the learning bug, and then I went to community college long enough where they said, you've taken all the classes. Have you thought about transferring to a four-year? I was like, oh, I'm here because I like taking classes, you know? And so I don't know how it happened, but I was living in the Bay Area. I mean, I know how it happened, but I was living in the Bay Area at the time, and I finished up my two-year at City College of San Francisco. And so I was like, well, I guess I'll apply to, Santa Cruz and Berkeley and San Francisco State. And I got into Berkeley as a high school dropout, going to Cal. I graduated from Cal with honors. I'm an honor student bear. And, you know, nobody in my life knows that. They just know that I went to, they know I'm a Cal grad with honors. You know, they don't know that, you know, they don't know where it started, but they know where it ended. And I had the learning bug again, and I ended up with a master's degree. I'm a high school dropout with a master's degree. I'm sure there are more of you out there because that's how we roll in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, but I started doing things like graduating and inviting my family to come watch me walk in funny black dresses across a stage. You know, I started inviting them to watch me take chips. They started to see the way you treated me and the way I treated you, and they started to experience how I knew to treat them at home because they saw it abundantly here when they got to come to meetings and rooms. And they got to tell me a little bit of their experience when they were invited to come hear me talk. And they heard about my experience of, you know, their experience of me. And healing happens every single time. And, you know, I did all the stuff and all the things, the letters, the reading, sponsor-directed amends. But I still have amends with my parents today. I mean, my dad, when I asked him, when I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous and asked my dad to give me away, it was a really funny joke. You know, my dad had already given me away multiple times, right? Dad, will you come give me away again? Ha, ha, ha. You know, so I'm getting married to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the room is filled with Alcoholics Anonymous. And my dad and I, my husband picked for our music, for our processional music, this like really beautiful, long, long, classical, beautiful Debussy song. And so my dad and I had this extended period in the back of the room before we walked down the aisle together. And my dad looked at me arm in arm and he wept. Tears in his eyes, he said, Julie, I have been awake all night. I cannot stop thinking about the miracle in our lives. Our family is so different because you got sober. I am so grateful. And I looked at him and said, Dad, I love you, and don't make me cry because I'm about to walk down the aisle. And another level and layer of healing happened that day. You know, another level and layer of healing happened. Before that, I made them grandparents because I, too, do it out of order. So I had boyfriend, baby, 2 years later, different husband. Okay, that's how I did it. And then we had two more babies, and now I'm single. So there you have it. I don't know if it's the right or the wrong way, but it's Julie's way in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's where we are right now. And, you know, but I became a single mom within 2 months of giving birth to my oldest. And I was living in San Francisco. Actually, I'd moved to Oakland. And my parents were living in Seattle. They had moved across the country, and they were up in Seattle. And so I was flying up, and I made them grandparents. And I got to watch them play with my little son the way that they must have played with me when I was a baby. And I got to see a different kind of humanity in them and a different kind of precious love that they had for this baby. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I bet they were like that with me, and some more healing takes place. You know, they didn't have to say anything. I just saw it, and I knew, you know, that I saw it, and I knew. And I will tell you also another story. I want to tell you a story about my mom. I'm going to tell you another story about my dad and a couple stories about my mom, and then we'll call it a wrap. But my dad, I had another moment with him somewhat recently. You know, the amends are made, the relationship is restored. You know, the last time I was in a lawyer's office with my dad was not like 2-3 months ago. He asked me, please, will you come to the attorney with us because we're redoing our estate and we want you to be the executor, you know? So from we can't have you in our home to you have all the codes and the passwords and we want you in charge of everything, you know, our end of life, our actually, they want my sister and I to jointly care for their end of life because as my dad said, and I quote, Julie will want to pull the plug too fast, and Alyssa won't have the heart to pull the plug. So together, they'll make a good, sane decision. That's my dad. That's who I'm. That's my dad. So my dad. So we're at my sister's house, and they have a fire pit in the backyard, and we're up late at night. My dad is caring for my mother, who is, as I said, on the decline with Alzheimer's. She's in bed. She's, you know, he puts her to bed in the guest house, and we're all sitting around the fire, and my dad, we start talking. Sometimes we tell old Julie stories, okay? Sometimes the old Julie stories come up, and it's an old Julie story, and there's always a good one when there's a new person involved because, you know, you get to bring the old stories out. So we're telling camping stories. My parents were big campers, grew up camping all over the Northeast. And, you know, I used to think they were really outdoorsy. I think they were probably pretty cheap. That was our vacation, right? We'd go sit in the woods in a tent growing up. Amazing. But drunk Julie, I tell you what, there is always a place to find a boy in a bottle. It's a really easy way to get drunk. So we would go camping and Julie would disappear. And there was one time when Julie disappeared, we're telling this story, my dad was like sharing how infuriated he was because we were in Virginia Beach, I think, and I disappeared. I had found somebody who was in the military and on leave for the weekend. So, you know, he was looking for a little extra than, you know. So we drank fuzzy navels on the beach and then I disappeared and I ended up in a scary tent. And I, this man was much older than me, and I was a very scared young girl. And at some point, he wasn't letting me leave. He wasn't letting me out. And at some point, I got my way to the bathroom. He followed me to the bathroom, and my dad had been out looking for me. And we ran into my dad, who faced down this guy. My dad's very tall. He's very formidable. And this guy just kind of turned around and ran away. And of course, I wasn't like, oh, thank God, Dad, you're here. You saved my life. I was like, you know, swore, angry, like, how dare you, you know, and he's like, you know, I mean, it was an ugly moment between me and my dad, a really ugly moment between me and my dad. So 30 years later, 35, 36, 40 years, I don't know, however long later, we're telling this story, and my dad is, you know, reliving this anger. And I looked at him. I said, you know what, Dad, that was a really scary night. And I think you might have saved my life. I was so grateful that you showed up. I couldn't tell you at the time because I didn't know how. I just couldn't say it. But you really changed the course of my life by appearing in that moment. It was like you were an angel. And my dad got tears in his eyes. And we kind of looked at each other and we had a moment. And then, you know, the night went on, and then the next morning over brunch, you know, I think it's gone and it's done. My dad grabs my hand at the breakfast table and looks at me with tears in his eyes again, and he said, thank you for changing history. You changed history for me. You gave me a whole new memory and a whole new daughter, and I got to be a whole different dad. Thank you. Thank you for that, you know. So I show up for these moments. These are the moments I show up. This is why I wash the dishes. You know, this is why I don't cheat at cards. This is why when I get invited, I go, and I go with a smile. My mom, my precious mom, I'm going to tell you, I already told you I have three children. They are all touched by this disease in some form or fashion. My oldest child is studying to be a sommelier. He's already passed level one. If you don't know what a sommelier is, it's a wine expert. It's how he gets to be around wine every day, all the time. He can tell you all about where it's grown and how it smells and what it looks like. I mean, the only wine I ever drank was like snuck out of my mom's refrigerator out of a box, like a bladder in a box. And I have no idea what it was. That's how much I know about wine. My son is a connoisseur. He's studying for level 2 psalm now. And we'll see where that goes. But when he was a teenager, he was drugs and booze all up in the house. I would wake up in the middle of the night, girls would be in his room. I mean, it just, he would disappear. I call my mom. And you know what? A mom, where their forgiveness and reconciliation has not occurred, you know what they say? They say things like, oh yeah, good, you finally got one. You got what you deserve. You got a daughter or you got a kiddo just like you, you know? Not my mom. My mom took my calls and she cried with me. She cried with me and she, like no other mother could, because she had been through this. She says, Julie, I know exactly how you feel. It is terrifying, and I was terrified every day. I said, Mom, I'm so sorry. I know I've said I'm sorry 100 times, but I have no idea what kind of heartbreak it is, what kind of fear it is to not know where your kid is and to know they're ripping and running out there, and I don't know if I'm going to get a call from the police. And thank God that kiddo is okay today. I mean, he's okay. He's doing well. Kiddo number two, I did get the police calls. I have ridden in ambulances. I've had to call 911. We have hospital bills from overdoses. And he, thank you God, is 6 years sober today in Alcoholics Anonymous. So number two is doing all right. Number three, my 18-year-old in COVID, again, in hospital rooms, suicide attempts, chronic depression. My whole COVID was like back and forth, in and out of treatment with this one. And, you know, and we're still writing the story. I have no idea, but my parents, they're watching and they're loving and they're hugging and they're supportive, because they've been there. I've done it. And now I get to walk through it, you know. And today my mom, my precious mom, she still lives with my dad. She still knows who we are for the most part, but she is going and she's going fast. And so I have all these fears, you know. Of course I have fears. I'm grieving, I'm losing her, she's slipping, she's not really my mom anymore. But I have this fear that she's gonna, you know how the Alzheimer's memory goes backwards. So you forget right now, and then you forget today, and then you forget last year, and then you start going back to the memories. And I'm just like, God, dear God, help her remember me as I am today. Help her, don't steal all of today for drunk Julie memories. Please, please don't do that. And we had this experience together also last year. A lot of stuff happened last year. My mom has a heart condition, and so she had a medication that required her to be in the hospital while they gave her this medication. So I, of course, take the week off of work, and I go sit in her room with her. You know, my dad takes a shift, I take a shift. You know, we go play King's Corner, we play solitaire, we play simple card games, because she can remember how to play simple card games. We're in this hospital room, and it's a double. So there's a curtain, which is the, I guess, privacy curtain, which I'm going to say there's not a lot of privacy with a sheet hanging on a rack between two beds. And I start to hear the familiar sounds of a doctor coming in and sitting at the foot of the bed and counseling somebody in the bed next to my mom. And this doctor says, here are your test results, blah, blah, blah. At this point, we can do something that will keep you alive not much longer, or we can go to hospice. And my mother and I have to listen to somebody decide whether they're going to take treatment or go to hospice. Thank you. And I start to hear the bargaining. She decides to go to hospice, and I start to hear the phone calls that sound like our kind of phone calls. Like, I know she hasn't talked to me in forever. Will you please just call and tell her I'm dying? I'm literally dying. Will you please just bring me some stuff? You know what I mean? Please bring me some stuff. And, you know, she's like old and skinny and, you know, tattoos worn. And, you know, she's one of us. She's one of us. So the next time my mom and I are taking a walking loop, my mom walks straight to this woman, because this is who my mom is, and says, holds her hand and says, I'm praying for you. Because she may be forgetting who we are, but she doesn't forget her manners, and she doesn't forget that God's in charge. She says, I'm praying for you. And I watch my mom do this, and I think, yeah, that's what we do. That's what I do. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. So I sit at the foot of this woman's bed, and you know, we get to know her a little bit, and I say, can I help you with anything? She says, well, my daughter hasn't talked to me in, you know, 10 plus years, and I know she lives in Florida, and I know blah, blah, blah. So I do a little detective work, and I find her. I find her on social media, and I find an address. And so I help this woman dictates a letter, and like a goodbye letter, an amends letter. You know, I'm here with your mom. She's going to hospice. She really wants to talk to you, but no, she can't. But she wants you to know that she loves you and she's going to watch over you in heaven. That's what she wanted me to write. So I wrote it. I didn't put a return address on it. I put a stamp on it and I sent it. My mom and I got to do that together. And the best part of all of that is when we were driving home from the hospital and I was telling my sister this story from the back seat. So my mom is only catching my side of it. I say something like, well, you know, she's my people. And my mom interrupts the call and turns around. She's like, you're nothing like that. You are nothing like that. Are you kidding me? And I thought, thank you, God. Another day where she gets Alcoholics Anonymous at her bedside, where she gets to see the person, the woman, the spirit, the child of God that you created here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I get to take home, you know, that I don't just keep here, that I take to work, that I take to my kids, that I take to even my ex, soon-to-be ex-husband, that I take to my parents, that I take on the street, that I do when I smile at the person checking my groceries, because we are saved to save another. You smile at me so I can smile at you and shine out there. We are God's kids walking this earth to carry a message. And it might not be the message of Alcoholics Anonymous as, I'm sorry you're drinking. It's the message of there's always hope and there's always love. In the face of despair and loss, we are miracles. We are miracles. Every single one of us that we don't drink, we can go out there and bring some joy and love and tenderness to somebody else. I learned every ounce of it here, and I thank you for every drop of it. Thank you.